RCR with Paul Brennan, Reality Check Radio.
Dr. Tetwu Lee is a PhD in biological sciences at the University of Auckland. He's there as a research fellow at the university. He has years of experience with PCR as a cell and molecular biologist. And we are curious about PCR. We've heard the term many times, but a lot of us think we're going to hear more about it with the advent of bird flu. So we thought we'd find out more about it, get our heads around it from myself and from an audience level. Dr. Lee, thank you for coming on. We really appreciate it.
Sure, thanks. Good to be here.
All right, first of all, what does PCR stand for?
Well, PCR stands for polymerase chain reaction. And we can probably break down that name into the component parts. So the first part, polymerase, refers to the DNA polymerase enzyme, which is the main component which does the actual amplification of DNA in it. So it's the machine, I guess, in the reaction, which does the work. Chain reaction refers to the way the reaction kind of explodes when you do a PCR. So what happens in a PCR is you are copying DNA, and by doing so, you cause an exponential amplification. So you imagine if you start off with one copy, PCR works in cycles, which we'll cover, but in the second cycle, you'll have 2, 4, 8. You can quickly see if you do 10 cycles, you end up with 1,000-fold, 20 cycles, you know, assuming 100% efficiency here, you'd end up with 1,000,000-fold, and 30 cycles, you'd end up with 1,000,000,000-fold. So you very quickly cause the amount of initial DNA in the sample to explode in almost like a chain reaction.
Right. What will that tell you?
Well, we use PCR for quite a lot of purposes. In this specific context, I guess we're talking about PCR for a testing method.
Yeah.
And an analogy, I guess, is often for testing, you might think of a needle in a haystack. So how do you find a needle in a haystack? The approach PCR uses, which is a little bit weird, is basically it multiplies that needle to millions of copies of that needle. And so if you've got 1,000,000 copies in of needle in the haystack, you can actually detect it more easily. And so if we stretch this analogy a little bit further, PCR also, you know, the needle, if you imagine as a piece of DNA, the needle may have a particular word on it, may say Paul on it. So we're after the needle which says Paul on it, and you can specifically using PCR make copies of that needle which say Paul on it, so you can say, oh yes, there really is a needle that says Paul in that haystack, as opposed to needles which say something slightly differently. So that's basically, you know, the idea behind it. By making a large number of copies of what's the original starting material, we can detect whether the material was there to start off with much more easily.
Okay, that's identifying it, but what's the resolution of that? How specific can you target that needle with my name on it?
You can target it. Well, there's a few components of that specificity. So we may have to take a few steps back and talk about how PCR actually works and how the DNA is actually arranged to go into that. So as everyone probably knows, DNA is this double helix structure. We often refer to it as an anti-parallel, two strands which are anti-parallel. So basically, there's two strands of bases joined together, which run in opposite directions. And that direction refers usually to the way enzymes in the cell process the DNA. So those two directions run in two opposite directions. So you can almost think of it like a road. You know, roads have two lanes, but they run in opposite directions. So on DNA, as everyone probably has heard, there's these bases, and they are often referred to as the rungs on the ladder. You know, you've got the backbone, and in between those, the backbone, you've got these rungs. And they're these bases, adenine, thymine, cytosine, and guanine. So these are known by the letters ATCG. And DNA just happens to have this property where those bases pair with each other. So A will always pair with T, and C will always pair with G. And this refers to the pairing on opposite strands. So if you take a look at the bases on opposite sides of a rung, you know, where the two strands come together, an A and a T will always be together, and a C and a G will always be together. And the reason this is important is you can imagine if you pull those two strands apart, you can then reconstruct the strand that is now missing just using those rules. So if there was an AT pair, you pull it apart, you know the T is now going, but you know there has to be another T there. So you can reconstruct the whole sequence back from one strand. And so this allows you to copy it, because you can imagine you pull it apart, you can then make copies from both of those sides you've pulled apart. And that's really how DNA replication happens in cells. And it's also how it happens when you do a PCR. So PCR itself, we're using an enzyme which works in the cells, which will normally replicate DNA, so the DNA polymerase. But the DNA polymerase, you know, it's designed to copy, make that, fill in the gap. So when you've got one strand, to make a copy of the other strand, but it can't start from scratch. It has to have a small piece of DNA already there. So it has to be a small piece of double-stranded DNA to start off with. And that's called a primer. In cells, there are special enzymes which can construct these primers and all that. But when we do PCR, what we do is we specifically design the primer and add it to the PCR reaction. And that primer is, there's two primers actually, but the primer sequences are one of the main determinants of how we determine the specificity. So what we'd have to do is we'd normally have to have some idea about what sequence we want to copy to amplify. Of course, we have to have some sequence information to construct those primers. But once we know that sequence, we can construct short pairs of DNA, usually about 20 bases long. And we chemically synthesize these. Usually, basically, if I was doing a PCR in a lab, I'd just, you order them online and you get it in the mail. It's chemically synthesized primer, which is a short piece of single-stranded DNA. And what that will do is when you pull apart those two strands, it will bind to one part, small fragment on one of those strands. And once it does that, when you add your polymerase, the polymerase will start extending that along. So you get, from your 20 base per bases, you get potentially thousands of bases after that, which are the copy of the original strand. And if you think about the process of copying, you actually need two primers, because you need one on each strand. So you need a 20 base pair sequence on each strand, and they are kind of downstream of each other. Because the DNA strands are running in opposite directions, they're both downstream from each other. And what you end up having is a copy of the sequence between those two primers. And that's the region, as you usually would call it, the target region, and that's the region you've amplified. If we go back to our road analogy here, I know there's a lot of, molecular biology here. So if you imagine you've got your road, your two lanes, you pull apart those lanes, which is a bit of a weird thing to do with a road, but, we just bear with it for this analogy. And what you need, the primer is almost like a prefabricated region of road. So you can't, your road construction machine, which is your polymerase, can't just start making the other lane on its own. It has to have a prefabricated region. You can imagine it has to roll in there first. Mm. And then once that is there, that prefabricated region is matching, the sequence of that road, which is already there. The roads don't have sequences, but bear with it. Yep. And then it will, the road making machine, the polymerase, will construct the rest of the road from that prefabricated region. That's probably how you can see it working. And so the specificity for a normal PCR, conventional PCR, is entirely determined by those two primer sequences. And it's, it's reasonably specific. I don't have any hard numbers. You'd probably need to get, it's not 100% matches. There are ways you can increase or decrease the stringency using various techniques, but you probably need something like 80 or 90% of the bases in each primer, at least, maybe more, to match before you would get any amplification actually happening. So the PCR won't happen.
I hope I've got it. So yep. Basically, you construct something from the original.
Yep.
And then you're looking at what you've constructed, but you know that it's come from a template of the original. Have I got that right?
Yeah, pretty much. So if you can think about, if we think about in virus examples, right? So what we would have to know is you'd have to know, if you want to detect whether a piece of viral RNA or DNA is in that sample, you need to know the sequence of the virus, because you need to construct your primers. But once you do have those sequences, you construct your primers to match that. And then if you run the PCR, and you do get lots of copies of those sequences matching those primers, it was actually the whole target region between the primers, then you can infer that that sample had DNA matching those two primer sequences in it. And so because the way DNA works, those bases are the information, if you like, you know, the genetic information. Every sequence is quite different from its, you know, there are some similarities, you know, obviously sequences are not completely different. But what people would do is specifically pick the sequences in a virus, which one are consistent across all variants of that particular virus, but two, not the same as a different virus, which I didn't want to detect. So that's how they determine how they would choose that specificity. Yeah.
What was it invented for? I've heard quotes from the inventor of it. I think he's now dead.
Yeah.
Only through social media. No, you know, no research or anything on my behalf.
Yep.
But I do remember someone saying a quote from that person. You might remind us who it is. That it was never kind of designed for diagnostic purposes necessarily.
Yeah.
Is that correct?
Yes, I would say that's true. Exactly what it was for, I suppose, I can't tell you that, but really, it was invented in the 80s. So molecular biology, I guess, is a field that grew up over the 60s, 70s, and 80s. And basically, people were looking for ways to manipulate DNA because DNA is genetic information. If you can manipulate it for in the lab, you can do all sorts of experiments when you can do that. So really, it was invented as a way of, I guess, copying DNA, which you could use for many different purposes.
Yeah.
So detection, as far as, you know, we're talking here about PCR as a detection method. In the lab, we'd use it for many different things, not just detection. We do use it for detection, but we also use it, for example, if we just wanted to copy a piece of DNA because we needed more copies, so we could use it in a downstream experiment, for example. That's one of the reasons we might use it. So that was probably the main motivation, just to copy, make a large number of copies. Because before that, what people would have to have done is a technique called cloning, where basically they use various other enzymes, things like restriction enzymes, which are these enzymes from bacteria which can cut up pieces of DNA. But they would use restriction enzymes to cut pieces of DNA, put them into a plasmid, which is a way of replicating, it's a vector for which will be copied in a bacterium, a piece of DNA which will copy itself in a bacterium. And you put that onto bacteria, and then you grow up those bacteria, and then you isolate that plasmid out. So it was a very inefficient way of copying DNA. So PCR was much, much easier compared to that. Yeah.
And what do you exactly use it for in your work?
Probably a main reason is actually detection, but detection in a different context. So, I suppose this is a good time to bring in quantitative PCR. So that technique I just described is, you know, the basics of PCR. There's another technique called quantitative PCR, which is qPCR, which is also the main method used for these diagnostic assays for various viruses. And the way this works is, PCR is somewhat quantitative. You know, basically there is a correlation between how much product you end up with, which how much you started with. But that quantification is not very good if you only look at the end. So if you only look at what's called endpoint PCR, where basically you run the whole thing for 30, 40 cycles and then look at it, you don't get a good quantification of how much you started off with, because the copying process is really only efficient at the start of the reaction. You can imagine once you've got so much DNA there, you run out of building blocks and stuff like that. So what quantitative PCR does is every cycle, so PCR is in cycles of different temperatures, and each cycle you potentially double the amount of material if it's 100% efficient. What quantitative PCR does is basically you add a detector to detect how much DNA is in that sample in real time. So it's also called real-time PCR. So when you do that, you get a plot of increasing amount of DNA against cycles, and you can estimate the number of cycles where the amount increases above a threshold, which you just set arbitrarily based on, you know, say 5% of the maximum or something like that. And that cycle is called the cycle threshold, the CT cycle. And this is used for detection. Often that CT cycle is just, if it's below a certain number, they say, yes, it's a positive test. But what we can use it for in the lab is something called gene expression assays. So cells in the lab, the genetic material is turned from DNA to RNA, which is a slightly different form of...
Could you explain the difference, please?
yes, okay. So DNA is... The main difference chemically is the backbone is slightly different. So the backbone of that ladder is slightly different chemically. One of the basins is different. There's uracil instead of thymine in the base in the middle there. But main difference is that the RNA tends to be single-stranded rather than double-stranded. And DNA is more like an information store, but RNA is used more as an intermediate in most, eukaryotic cells, or not any cells pretty much, not viruses, I guess, any cells. So bacteria to mammalian cells or anything. So the main genetic material is stored as DNA, but to work with that genetic material, to actually do something with it, one of the things a cell might do is make a copy of a small piece of the DNA that's a gene. And that gene, often most genes get turned into proteins. And so what the cell does is makes an RNA copy of that gene, it's called transcription, turns that into an RNA copy, and then that RNA copy goes outside, if it's a mammalian cell, goes outside the nucleus, which is where the DNA is stored, and then is used, there's a molecular machine in the cell called a ribosome, which you basically read that RNA sequence and turn it into a protein sequence. Wow. So it's quite a remarkable thing where it reads these triplets of those bases, and each of those bases codes for a different amino acid. And so it turns those triplets into a chain of amino acids, which is a protein. And the function of a protein is determined by its chemical properties, which is ultimately determined by, coded for by the gene. So in cells, it's not the store of the information. It's more a intermediary between...
A copy and paste.
Yeah, something like that. There are RNA molecules which actually are functional. They're not just get turned into proteins. But I guess RNA is just the molecule which does stuff more than DNA. DNA is kind of, you've got a book, but you may want to work with anything in your book. You have to copy it out before you can actually...
It's the editing function.
Yeah, editing function. Yes.
Brilliant design, isn't it?
It's very remarkable how it works and stuff like that. Yes, so if we go back to that concept where we've made copies of RNA copies, we've transcribed copies. It just so happens, not all the genes in a cell are turned on at all the time. So what you can detect is whether you want to see whether the genes are turned on. This is something we call expression, gene expression. You can detect how many copies of RNA of a gene there are. Right, you can imagine if you got a billion copies, that's definitely turned on and is turned on to a high degree. Whereas if you got it 1,000 copies, it's turned on to a much lower degree.
Right.
So what we like to use qPCR for is just specifically looking at how much RNA for a particular gene is present in a cell. So we take a cell, get the RNA from it, and we have to do something called reverse transcription. Because PCR won't work on RNA, we need another enzyme which turns RNA into DNA. But once we've done that, we can then use PCR, quantitative PCR, to detect how much of the RNA is there. And that's a technique called reverse transcription quantitative PCR, RT-qPCR. And it's also the technique used for RNA viruses, such as SARS-CoV-2 and influenza. And so what we routinely do this, we might manipulate some cells and see what's happening to them. Oh, look, this gene is gone up, and that might tell us what that gene is doing, or it might tell us what the treatment we applied to those cells are doing, because we know this gene is important, say, for cell survival. And if it's gone up, maybe our treatment is influencing that in some way. So that's probably one of the main techniques in our lab we would use PCR for, because it's a very good technique for quantifying amounts of RNA. And most of that quantification, I did talk about copies, but really we're doing that in a relative sense. We're basically seeing, is it more or less from one sample to another. It is possible to quantify exact number of copies, which to do that, you'd have to have standards where you know how many copies are and you run PCR on that, but that's not done very routinely. In terms of diagnostic purposes, usually, as I said, a test is called positive if you detect a cycle threshold below a certain number. That threshold, I suppose, can vary depending on the test. You can infer some properties from that cycle threshold. There was, during COVID and detection of SARS-CoV-2, there was a lot of talk about the cycle threshold, the CT values, because what people found was that when you had positive tests with very high CT values, which means there's very small amount of original starting material, you didn't tend to get much. Well, when you take that material and put it on cultured cells, there was no killing of the cells. There was no live virus produced. Whereas when you took samples which had a low CT, which implies there's a lot of RNA there, there were cells in RNA that you could detect virus being replicated, I suppose is the best way of putting it.
Okay.
So, you know, there was possible to make some correlations between the cycle threshold, the CT, and whether or not there was live virus present in the sample. But it's really that that cycle threshold is not an absolute measure. It's going to depend on the test. It's going to depend on how they did the test and all that. So you could calibrate it for a particular test, but it's a bit of a rough number. It doesn't really, you know, tell you anything definitive.
I want to ask you a question about accuracy, because I had a personal experience of this, and yep. I'm sure many of our listeners have.
Yep.
I tested positive for COVID on a visit to hospital, actually, nearly 2 years ago. Much to my surprise, there for a heart problem, which is well fixed now, I'm happy to say. And there was a look of shock, horror. He's got COVID. And that was from a PCR test, which I don't even remember them doing because I was kind of out to it, getting a stent put in. But I never had any symptoms of anything. I never felt unwell. I guess asymptomatic is the word. And it made me wonder about the accuracy, because if I didn't feel anything, you know, I'm thinking, well, I don't have anything.
Yes.
So can we explain that?
Yes. Okay. So that's a big kind of, that is a big issue with PCR tests, I suppose, what a positive test means. So I've talked a little bit about specificity in terms of the primers. I'll just mention briefly, so one issue is if you did a PCR with only primers, you know, it is definitely possible to get a positive test, you know, from sequences that don't quite match. With qPCR, actually, there's another component on it. We actually, because we need to detect how much DNA is in real time, one technique is called TACMAN, which is a combination of the word TAC, which is the type of polymerase we use, and PacMan. And the reason it's called that is, I'll explain how it works, is TACMAN uses a third small piece of DNA, the third prefabricated lane, if you like, which is called the probe sequence. And that matches somewhere in the middle of those two primers to one of the strands. And what happens with that probe is when you do your PCR, it will bind in the middle of one of those strands. And when your DNA polymerase comes along, you can imagine it's starting from the primer, it's coming along. Eventually, it may encounter a probe sequence there. So that other piece of road that's just in the middle there somewhere. And what this polymerase does is it's actually got another activity where it will actually destroy any DNA in its path pretty much. And so that it's like a bulldozer. It will go over that prefabricated road and destroy it. And that probe is specially designed that when it's destroyed, it will fluoresce, so you can detect how much DNA is. You can imagine that piece of road, you know, there's paint there, say, barrels of paint, and when that bulldozer runs over it, it bursts open those paint
barrels. Yeah, you're going to notice it. Yeah.
And you're going to notice it. So that's how it detects. And that probe actually makes a big difference from the specificity, because one of the weaknesses with the primers, if you think about what happens, is the primers actually get incorporated into your product. So let's say you've got a mismatched primer, so one which isn't 100% match in one cycle, and the next cycle, because that primer was the original sequence of the primer in it, you've got 100% match. With a probe, you never do that. So you've got two things. One, you've got a third sequence that has to match, and secondly, you never incorporate the probe into the product. So you have to, it's much more stringent, that sequence. So firstly, going back to your positive test, okay, the qPCR, I'm reasonably confident it's positive for that actual piece of RNA, which the COVID, that virus, SARS-CoV-2 virus, it's not likely to be any other virus. It's probably, you do have that piece of RNA in your track, and that RNA, as far as we know, is only in that virus, and it's quite likely to be the case because, you know, sequences mutate quite quickly. But then, you know, so it's, I guess we'll think about what else could happen. So there's a piece of RNA, viral RNA in that sample. Could it have come from somewhere anywhere else? Well, when you do a PCR, it actually is very easy to contaminate the samples if you do it wrong.
Right.
Because it's so sensitive. And when you do PCR, you know, there can be pieces of DNA just floating around the lab, and you end up with it in your tube. We usually use plates, but whatever, in your tube. And it will produce a positive result if you're not careful. But There are ways to overcome that. Obviously, you do your procedures properly. You do your controls to make sure you're not getting a false positive in that sense. So if it's done technically well, you know, it's very unlikely to be a false positive due to contamination because you can detect that and rule it out. There was during COVID when people were rushing to detest the virus SARS-CoV-2, I heard about how they were doing things in the UK. And it did seem a bit dodgy, you know, and it's possible, you know, who knows how well the controls were done. But if they're not well done properly, you can easily get a false positive in the sense that it was not from you. It was just floating around somewhere. And the person doing the PCR didn't do it well. But if you do it well, you can eliminate possibility. Okay. But okay, so then assuming we have done it well, you did have that piece of viral RNA in your breathing in them. But what does that mean? If you're not sick,
what I was thinking.
What happened when COVID is a positive test was used to infer you were a case, but that's not usually how cases were diagnosed. Usually what you do is you were sick, you go to a doctor, and the doctor would say, I wonder what's causing you to be sick. So because maybe we can decide what treatment to prescribe you. And then they'd do a test downstream of that and look, oh, maybe you've got flu, maybe you've got something else, maybe you've got COVID, and maybe that influences how we treat you. So in that sense, if you're testing lots of people which aren't even sick, I guess you can come up with this idea of a clinical false positive. So if you think about actually having to have clinical symptoms as being a positive, if you have no symptoms, are you a positive?
Well, they treated me like I was for a week. You know,
yes,
like
because,
I was,
and that was
Typhoid Mary, you know.
Yeah, and if we explore this concept a bit further, you can find various studies which have looked at samples of people they consider healthy. So for various reasons, people might be interested in looking at viruses in people's respiratory tracts. So maybe they're looking at sick people versus healthy people. Maybe, you know, there's a recent study I looked at which was looking at asthmatics, and they match those to healthy control samples. And these were children 3 to 17. They were healthy controls, so apparently no sickness or wheezing, no sign of asthma or anything like that. And between, you know, depending on the age of the subject, between maybe 10 and 20% tested positive by PCR for various viruses. There was coronaviruses there. These samples were taken before COVID was a thing. What other viruses were there? There were RSV, the respiratory syncytial virus, come up. So it does seem like even among healthy people, you detect these viruses in them. And so what are we inferring when you have a PCR positive test? If you think about what happened traditionally back in the day, people used to think bacteria were very nasty. Now we know that if you didn't have any bacteria in you, you'd be dead, because you have these bacteria in your gut, for example, that you need to live. And that's the concept of your microbiome, which is not just in your gut, it's throughout your body. My personal opinion is about, in terms of respiratory viruses, I suspect there is a virome that people have in their respiratory tract as well.
Right, yeah.
You know, I've got no hard and fast evidence of this or anything like that. It's kind of speculation, but I suspect humans evolved or designed, if you like, to maintain a virome. And the reason I'm speculating about this is I can actually infer reasons why it would be advantageous to do that. It's all very circumstantial, but if you think about a lot of things people do, for example, people kiss, people share food, they share saliva. A lot of the things we do, like, seem to be unhygienic, right? We're like, why are we doing all those things? And you'd think that these behaviors, if they really were so detrimental to human populations, I would have suspected they would have died out. But they're universal across all human cultures. So it's almost like we are deliberately spreading our viromes. And that would make sense, because that's a concept in the microbiome, for example. It's known we do, you know, like babies have to, their gut has to be colonized by bacteria they receive from the environment and from their mothers and stuff like that, and that can make a difference to their microbiome. And in terms of respiratory viruses, if you think about it, well, a human population having a novel virus which no one has encountered before is actually not a great thing to encounter, because you've got no immunity to that virus if it's completely novel. So if a population ever encounters a virus, maybe it's a good thing for that population to keep it around. at a low level, because, you know, people think that viruses are bad and they cause me to be sick, which is kind of true. But in some sense, everything is coexisting in biology. You know, viruses coexist with animals and plants and all that kind of stuff. They're not, and you never really be able to eliminate them. So to some degree, there's got to be some coexistence happening there. And so one good way for populations potentially is to allow them to coexist. And you can imagine when you're spreading this virome, it's when you're healthy and all that, maybe it's a good thing for our immunity. And maybe it is a way we maintain that immunity in our populations so that we don't get that sick. Because I presume what happens, so you get infected with a virus, most of the time you are completely well, like you were. You know, you had the positive test, so you've probably been exposed to that virus. Probably some of your cells did reproduce it, but your immune system kept it under wraps, and so it wasn't a big deal. And you probably, you know, either you're maintaining that in you, maybe, who knows? The sample is just a small part. How do we know how many viruses are there? But even then, maybe it's just meant to be circulated amongst a population at a low level is not a bad thing to be happening. And that's quite controversial, probably, when we
it makes a lot of sense.
I think it makes sense.
Intuitively, yes. You know?
It does make sense intuitively. Like I said, I don't have any evidence for it. It's pretty speculative. But for respiratory viruses in particular, I suspect there is some advantage of keeping them around in populations. Mm-hmm. So that,
otherwise, we wouldn't kiss. Or do anything else in close proximity.
Yes. Yes, exactly. So, you weren't sick, so what did it matter? Perhaps we shouldn't be making such a big deal of a positive test if you are not sick.
Well, they were quite gleeful, I sort of picked up, because here's another one. And also the speed of it. I do remember that. It was pretty quick once I realized I'd done it from where to go. You know, it was probably less than an hour to get the result back. So I don't know how fast you do things in a lab, but that seemed to take no time at all. Right.
This is definitely a PCR test. It wasn't a rat test?
No, it was a PCR.
Okay. I mean, you can do PCRs very, very quickly because all you do is, you know, you take a sample, you put it, there's a fixed procedure, you know, put it in a tube with everything else you need in it, and you run it in a PCR machine is what we call it, which basically changes the temperature in that sample and detects how much DNA is there. And you can definitely run them under an hour if you really want to.
Okay. Coming up against time, I've got a quote here from American biologist Carrie Mullis from 1997, and I think you're aware of this.
Yeah.
With PCR, if you do it well, you can find almost anything in any body. Now, okay, great breakthrough in technology, efficiency of what people like you do, but that is open to be used, right?
Yes.
That quote.
Yeah, so that quote circulates a lot. I think it's from 1997, and specifically he's talking about HIV detection. Kind of is taken out of context a little, because if you read what he's talking about the rest of that interview, he kind of talks about, well, you know, he was a little bit of a skeptic about HIV causing AIDS, I gather. And so he was wondering why you would make a big deal of a positive HIV test when there may be lots of other richer viruses, in particular that HIV is a type of richer virus, in that sample. And so I think in terms of, people often refer to, I mean, you can detect, always will get a positive test if you have a sample. That's not the case, as we covered in specificity. qPCR with the probe is pretty specific. I'm pretty sure you have to have a very strong match. You know, I can't give you numbers, but you have to have a strong match to that sequence. So you do have to have that positive sequence. But like you were saying, what do you make of that positive test, and what were we discussing? And people have kind of lost sight, I think, because they just think of PCR as an objective way to tell you a virus is there. I think we really have to take a step back and think about what that really means. Is it clinically relevant or not is probably the big thing. It's a useful tool, but it probably has to be used properly and not taken out of context, which I think Harry Mullis was kind of strongly suggesting there. We should take caution as to how we interpret a positive test.
It's been fascinating having you on. Thank you so much for taking us through that. Maybe some of us will have to listen to the replay a couple of times just to cram it all in.
Sure.
But I think you explained that in a great way. Dr. Tetwu Lee, PhD in Biological Sciences, University of Auckland. Again, appreciate your time and your expertise. And if we've got any more questions about PCR, we'll be back in touch, you can bet, all right?
Sure. Sure.
Loving what you're hearing? Well, the establishment hates it. And right now, they're conjuring up new ways to try and censor RCR. To ensure you never miss a beat of the hard-hitting news you've come to know and love, make sure you're on the RCR mailing list. Get connected now at realitycheck.radio/email.